Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Coming up on Chopper's Politics.
This establishment of the Church of England is not something I call for because I want Christianity tip-exed out. I just think that it's not right to have a state religion. It's not the job of the state. I also think it kind of pollutes the church.
Hello, I'm Christopher Hope, the Associate Editor for Politics at the Daily Telegraph, and welcome to your weekly edition of Chopper's Politics. Well, I'm sitting here in the Red Lion pub at my usual table amongst all the tinsel and decorations for Christmas, reading the Telegraph, and it's not happy reading. Britain is descending into chaos, and the Tories are powerless to stop it, says my colleague Alistair Heath in Thursday's paper. And that's quite a good jumping off point for this week's podcast. Coming up, I've got Simon Clarke, the former Levelling Up Secretary, here to talk to us about how the Tories can get back on the front foot. Also, William Ragg, Tory MP for Hazelgrove and chairman of a major House of Commons committee, who said this week he's quitting politics at 34. Why? And later on, Tim Farron, the former Lib Dem leader, on why faith and politics can and maybe should mix. But first up, Simon Clarke was Levelling Up Secretary in Liz Truss's government and served in many roles under Boris Johnson before he resigned as Prime Minister. Now back on the back benches, Simon Clarke is free to speak his mind, and he's got some real wake-up calls for the Tories, not least on the need to bring back wind farms onshore and also not to get rid of these centrally set housing targets, which have so upset some members in the south of England. Simon Clarke, welcome to Chopper Politics, a very festive Red Lion pub.
Yes.
Hope you're enjoying the decorations around us.
I feel positive as I should be in my Santa outfit.
Quite right. Let's look at you briefly then. You were a Levelling Up Secretary in Liz Truss's government for those 44 days when she was Prime Minister. Before that, of course, you had roles in the Treasury. You've been around for a bit now. You know that the Tory party policy is not to have onshore wind farms. Why do you want to change that?
Well, I want to change it because I think that our current policy is unsustainable. We have a de facto blanket ban on new onshore wind, and that is, I think, very hard to sustain economically. Onshore wind is the cheapest form of energy generation today, without exception, renewable or non-renewable. I think it's very hard to justify that we have a ban at a time when, obviously, energy bills are so much in the news and on people's minds. Mm. But then, clearly, there's a question of energy security that's linked to that, and there is a question of our environmental commitments, which are legally binding. And this is one of the simpler ways that is open to us to meet those demands. And the wider point here is that the amendment that I've tabled to the Levelling Up Bill is explicitly about empowering communities. So I am very clear that if a local community does not want onshore wind, it should not have it. And it most certainly should not have it imposed.
Defined by what? So how, ten miles from the site?
Defined by that I would, under the terms of this amendment, remove the right of developers to appeal if a council says no to a given application. There would be no automatic right of appeal. And that would remedy the situation which colleagues were rightly concerned about in the run-up to the 2015 election, whereby developers were routinely winning these appeals and forcing decisions on communities.
How about money off bills for communities affected by these?
I would certainly favour that. And what's really interesting,
how much?
Well, I think that in a way is not for the government to determine, if you like. I think what we ought to do is step out of the business of trying to regulate this and allow companies like Octopus, who said that they would offer £400 would be a very topical sum,
yes.
But the reality is it is absolutely, I think, a matter for negotiation between communities and companies, and all I'm saying is that if somewhere does want onshore wind, the government should be saying they can't.
You're going back to localism here, aren't you?
Yes.
This idea which David Cameron championed, which is the idea of being a Conservative Party government backing out of running people's lives and let communities decide what to do.
And I think the point here is, which I've been making to colleagues over recent days, either we can address the onshore question now with localism at its heart and enshrined in the legislation, or a future Labour government, and there will one day be a Labour government, we hope not for a long time, but we have to be realistic, the wheel will turn.
Well, we're all Democrats, Simon.
We're all Democrats
here. You can't have 1,000 years of Tory rule, even if you might want that.
Absolutely, and you know that is a pressing reality, and onshore wind will be brought back by a Labour government.
Well, there's a dash for green. I mean, they're going to bring a dash. Absolutely. And by its nature, it sounds like they're going to really go for onshore wind.
They would do it without enshrining this community consent lock. So I think we either address this issue now, or we will have to deal with it in due course in a less favourable way for communities.
What about bird strike? Literally cutting birds up these windmills.
I think all of this
noisy.
Is slightly overblown. I mean,
would you live near one?
Well, the reality is, if I or another didn't want to have... I mean, I personally have no objection to turbines, but the point is, if a community doesn't want it, they wouldn't have it. But lots of places do want it, and there is no question that companies do know communities where there is a suppressed appetite for this, and it can't be realised, and that is absolutely crazy.
So, Simon Clark, you say they want the government to butt out of being involved in decision-making, but you want them to be involved in setting central housing targets. How do you square that?
Well, I want there to be some constructive pressure to build the homes that this country needs. And I am all in favour of addressing some of the undoubtedly legitimate concerns that communities experience around rates of house building in part of the country. And I think there's a lot more we can do around both infrastructure and making sure that existing communities get the NHS infrastructure, the schools, the roads, which make new development palatable, and also, frankly, receive some of the uplift. I see no problem with house building leading to potentially even reductions in council tax in areas that accommodate it.
Is that being looked up by the government?
Well, it's something which certainly when Liz was in office, we were talking about direct incentives, if you like, for communities to welcome new homes. I think there's a lot we can do around that. There's a lot we can do around design codes and actually making sure that new homes are built well rather than just the classic, you know, boxes being dumped in a field. And, you know, that is all important. But if we abolish all targets, which is what's being discussed by some of my colleagues, we will, I'm afraid, end up with a NIMBYs charter. That is the blunt reality of what that would mean. And independent assessment suggests that at a time when at the moment we build about 250,000 new homes a year, which is the highest levels for 30 years, but still short of what we need, we would see a reduction of about 100,000 in that were we to abolish all the targets. So it would be a massive blow to the house building industry. And critically, we do as Conservatives surely believe in a property owning democracy. This goes to the heart of why we want to build these homes. It's giving people a stake in society.
Often you convert them into Tory voters.
Well, you do.
Shows.
And I think that there is a very short-sighted element to the we must stop building debate. As I say, I get the pressures, and I'm happy to try and address those in targeted ways. But to reach the conclusion that the only way to solve this problem is to say all targets must go is the equivalent of saying that you don't like turkey and therefore you must close all shops. It's a very blunt tool.
Is the answer ratio? So what the complaint appears to be that you have large numbers of homes imposed on communities where there's quite a small hamlet or village or town and it's not really ready for that kind of volume. If you had a ratio linking the target to numbers of homes already there, that could mean it would be incremental rather than imposing large.
You certainly could look at issues like this. And this goes to the point, Chris, that there are ways of finessing this argument without, as I say, using a sort of sledgehammer approach, which does, I think, work against both the economic and the social imperatives we want to see tackled, because it is totally crazy that young people really in most parts of the country without parental help cannot buy a home of their own. I mean, that is not sustainable. And we can only address this by fundamentally addressing issues of supply and demand.
Isn't the problem, though, Simon Clark, that your party is a party of NIMBYs, that they don't want development near them? Or perhaps they're bananas? As you know what banana stands for, don't you? Against building absolutely anything near anyone, anywhere.
And this is a characterisation we have to resist. Fundamentally, I think we need to be the party that's on the side of people who want to build a better life for themselves.
And aspiration, to quote.
I am a Thatcherite to my core, and I am not in the business of protecting the cosy vested interests of people who already have a very fortunate lot in life. I'm all in favour, clearly, of trying to make sure that we do protect the countryside and protect the interests of existing communities. But that cannot be at the expense of the next generation. And it will be an electoral suicide note for the Conservative Party if we continue what we have already, I'm afraid, started to see happen in London and the wider South East now, which is this ripple effect of people who are not voting Conservative, in part at least, because they can't see any way to acquire capital in their lives. That is totally unsustainable for us. It is a dream for Labour. High prices and high rents are turning a generation of young people away from the party which ought to be meeting their needs.
If you're building record numbers, 250,000 homes a year, why is the price of a home not coming down?
Well, the objective assessment is we need 300,000 a year to keep, pace, so it's still too light. And really, to get ahead of the problem, you need to be building in excess of 300,000 a year. The simple reality is that, you know, I represent an area of suburban Teesside, and the average house price in my neck of the woods is sort of £180,000-£200,000 for a three-bedroom, four-bedroom family home. If you're a nurse or a teacher, you know, you can absolutely see your way on a salary of £40,000 a year to owning a really nice family home. And that is important. It's not the sole determinant of whether someone votes Conservative, but goodness me, if you can't see your way to that, don't be surprised when people don't vote for us.
Is it a Southern Tory issue?
Yes, it is.
It's not really a Northern issue.
It's not a Northern issue at all. And I get, right, that the skewed economics of this country, which we are also trying to address through levelling up, so this is all of a piece, mean that there are population flows which apply particular pressure to the successful parts of the country. And actually, this is one of the best arguments in favour of the levelling up agenda to Southern voters.
Sense of place.
It would relieve pressure on the South if we had a more dynamic and successful North and Midlands. And that's one of the many reasons why we should be trying to pursue this agenda.
And you see a moral need, do you? I mean, a lot of voters have had the advantage of quite cheaper property prices, but then their children, their grandchildren can't go on the ladder at all.
Well, this is the point, and I would certainly say this to people who are listening to this and who have, you know, obviously benefited from the extraordinary windfall in the last couple of generations around property prices, that clearly, even if it's worked out okay for them, and you know that I don't begrudge them that, but even if it has, their children, and most particularly their grandchildren, are going to be the ones who are scuppered by this, because the number of, you know, under 30s still living at home is at a record high, and that's not because of some desire for the most part of these young people to live with their parents. It's because they've literally got no option.
You mentioned the levelling up agenda, and of course you were at the heart of Liz Truss's operation. You were one of the four Quad ministers just making big choices. Do you miss being in the heart of government?
Yes. I mean, there's no point shilly-shallying around. It is an enormous privilege to serve in government, and both Boris and Liz gave me the chance to serve in their cabinets, and I'm very grateful for that. I mean, clearly there are upsides to being out of government, not least that you can say sometimes what you actually think rather than what you are.
It's your first time out of government for some years, isn't it?
Well, it is, and the reality is that that's an adjustment personally and politically. But it's not. I don't want to sort of make myself out to be sort of stricken with grief. There are lots of things I want to pursue, but obviously we're in politics because we actually want to make a difference. We have a Conservative majority, and I'm very keen that we should use that majority, and I would love to be part of that. But it's a question, obviously, of the right time, the right opportunity, and I do sincerely wish Rishi and the new government success, because it is in our collective interest that we should make a meaningful degree of progress with the enormous challenges we face as quickly as possible, because obviously the election is now probably under 2 years away, and notwithstanding the fact we've had some really awful external events to deal with, there is a clear need now for delivery.
And that's happening slowly and slowly. I mean, it's baby steps, someone says to me. I mean, Alistair Heath talks about in the Telegraph on Thursday that Britain is descending into chaos and the Tories, your party, are powerless to stop it. Do you agree with Alistair Heath?
I think what Alistair is saying will reflect the frustration that many of us feel, that our public services in particular appear to be in such a challenging place. And that is, you know, that is partly a challenge for us about institutional reform. And I think there is a particular need, which I know Steve Barclay recognises, to address the NHS. And, you know, we're spending roughly the GDP of Greece on this institution, and yet outcomes are very mixed.
There's a feeling that Britain isn't working.
Correct.
to misquote the famous "Labour isn't working"
advert. And this is a multi-dimensional problem. And some of it sits in the government's gift. Some of it is clearly in the gift of the unions, who are absolutely at the moment running amok. And there is a real need.
Are you to blame? You've been in power for 12 years, or do you blame Liz Truss personally?
No. I said you don't blame Liz. I think that mini budget. I think the reality is that we've had sort of whole flock of black swans, which are unexpected events. Which have, you know,
COVID, Ukraine,
obviously the wider challenges, frankly, of the last 10 years after the financial crisis, and all of the undoubted pressures that have come at us have been hard to manage. But we need, as a government, I think, to set out an authentic Conservative vision for what comes next. I think the public actually do recognise broadly that we've been dealt an immensely challenging hand, and they certainly have no truck with Starmer and Labour. There is minimal pull factor to the opposition, but we need to make sure there is a clear Conservative vision for what comes next, and critically, an optimistic Conservative vision. I think that that is at the heart of what Liz was trying to essay out, and it's what we need to return to.
And just briefly on Liz Truss, how is she?
Liz is on, I think, very stoic form. I mean, no one would deny that the experience of what happened is pretty awful on a human level, but she is stoic, and she's determined to keep fighting for the values that matter, be that obviously a more dynamic and open economy, strength abroad, not least in our dealings with the European Union.
What role will she have? Will she go to America? Let's talk of her going to America.
Well, I think Liz will want to champion the best of global practice in terms of making sure that Britain is, as I say, a dynamic and successful economy. And there are lessons from America, there are lessons from the emerging economies of the Far East as well as elsewhere on this. And I think she will want to carve out a space whereby the failure of parts of her agenda doesn't cloud the underlying importance of what it is that she was saying, which is that Britain is not competitive enough. We are not, frankly, tackling some of the underlying challenges, which if we don't address them, and house building is one of many that this country faces, it will be to our collective detriment, and it will see a real terms fall in living standards.
She'll carry on as an MP, as far as you know, after the next election?
Yes, no, she's determined to.
How will this remember her, do you think?
I think there is an element. I mean, clearly that will be one of the takeaways. But I think, hopefully, more importantly, they will recognise her as someone whose diagnosis of the fundamental problems with our economy and society was broadly on the money. And just as the Heath government in the early 70s recognised but failed to succeed in their battle against the unions, the problems of industrial relations, which Margaret Thatcher would later go on to address successfully, I think there will be an element of having been something of a prophet in her own land.
And just finally, will Boris be back?
Well, look, Boris is an immensely talented and...
You're a big supporter.
I mean, look, when he came back last month. For me, Boris is the most significant politician of this generation, and there were reasons why he won that thumping mandate in 19. A hugely personal mandate. And I think, you know, look, with Boris Johnson, in life, you can never say never. But for now, our focus needs to be on making sure that this government succeeds. Yes. And I know Boris himself, were he here, would be the first to say that. We have a job to do in 24, and that is winning as the United Party under Rishi Sunak.
On that note, Simon Clark, thank you for joining us in a festive Red Lion pub today on Chopper's Politics Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Simon Clark there. And we'll put a link to Alistair Heath's column in the show notes for this episode. Now, so far in this Parliament, 12 Tory MPs have said they are standing down and won't fight the next general election. That's not as many, anywhere near as many, as quit ahead of the 1992 election. That was more like 40 or 50. But some critics are worried that people with a long road ahead of them in politics are leaving. One of those is William Ragg, who entered politics aged just 27 in 2015 and is now quitting aged 34. Why? William Ragg, Tory MP for Hazelgrove, welcome to Chopper's Politics. Great to have you on.
It's great to be on.
How old are you, Will?
Oh, goodness me. I think I'm 34.
You're 34. Why are you calling time on your political career in your early 30s?
Well, it's a bit perverse, isn't it, I admit. I think my misspent youth was getting into Parliament at the age of 27. And I think the most shocking aspect of my announcement was that people realised what my age is, given that I've tried over the years in an affected way to convince people that I'm older, if not maturer, than might
your
be assumed.
Young years, your callow years. You want to be a politician for a long time.
Yeah.
All your life, would you say?
All my, of course. I mean, people tend to be quite bashful and say, oh, no, I never wanted to. No, it's something that occurred by accident. Becoming a member of Parliament doesn't occur by accident. You have to have a special type of people, if I can put it generously.
Yes. Well, let's go on to those people in a minute. Hmm. But yourself, I mean, you were, when you were 10, 11, 12, were you thinking I can be an MP?
I was always interested in politics and current affairs. I thought it was important to do something a little different before, which is sort of where I dipped my toe in the water of teaching for a time. But yeah, I always had the ambition. I didn't quite know how I was going to realise that ambition, but it was something that I wanted to do.
So why are you leaving then? Why are you going now?
For me, it's a decision that I've come to after a good number of months of thinking. And if I can put it this way, as tritely as possible, it seems to me to be the right thing for me. Now, that might sound extremely selfish, but I've learned that occasionally putting yourself first is not always selfishness. And
self-preservation.
Indeed. And a lot has happened in the time that I've been a Member of Parliament. Mm. You know, if I say rather grandly, we're now my fifth Prime Minister. Okay, it's as if that, you know, 20 or 30 years of political goings-on has been squashed and truncated into a very small space.
Because you were elected in May 2015, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot has happened then. If you think about the referendum, a leadership contest, early general election,
Brexit,
all that minor going on. And
are you worn out by it?
No, I'm not worn out. I mean, you do become worn out at times, but you can restore yourself to it. But it really is a positive step that I've made for myself. And the reason I've done so this far out, I suppose, 18 months, best part of 2 years, presumably, until the next general election, is so that I can acclimatise to it. Because, you know, as a institutionalised and de-skilled Member of Parliament seeking readmittance to the human race, it might take a little bit of time to adjust.
Because all the building blocks were there for you, Will Ragg. You were chairman of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee. You're on the board of the 1922 Committee of Backbench Tory MPs. A knighthood is probably 10 years away if you stayed in post.
Well, it's very kind to imagine.
You constructed the framework of a successful backbencher, if that's what you wanted to be, a parliamentarian. We're all in place.
Well, leave them wanting more, Chris.
Is your decision to go linked to what happened last summer? You made that extraordinary statement, didn't you, when you were chairman of that PACAC committee about bullying by whips?
Well, it was quite a wide-ranging statement, which I made then, because I saw injustices happening to a number of colleagues and influence being unfairly applied to them. And there was all kinds of things going on with the, particularly the shadow whipping operation, if we cast our minds back to that. And I didn't like to see people put in a very invidious position. And so I felt the only way that something might be done about it and for that kind of behaviour to desist, which it did, was to say something.
Just remind the listeners what you said at the time, because it was to do with
there was pressures being exerted on those who had declared publicly or were believed to be in favour of a confidence vote in the then Prime Minister,
Boris Johnson.
And the way that it appeared to me to be organised suggested that kind of bullying behaviour, which I don't really have much time for.
No, you went to the police about it?
Well, they asked to see me about it, but just to a slight minor change of emphasis there.
And they asked to see you, and you saw them, and nothing came from it?
Well, nothing came of it in that respect, but the behaviours that were displayed stopped, and those colleagues who had been, had various unsavoury things threatened.
They are now?
I won't do it because it will betray their confidence. I thought the whole point of me doing it in the way that I did was to protect them from any more anxiety than that which they were already feeling.
Do you think that your leaving may be a wake-up call for that kind of behaviour going forward in Parliament?
Well, I think it's changing anyway. I think there have been some behaviours that are learned behaviours that are copied. And I think that, that for a time, that, that there were a number of individuals who I'm not going to dwell upon, who were in positions of authority and influence, who misused that. Mm. And I don't regret doing what I did. I might regret not thinking about its impact on me, but 'twas ever so.
Yes, you took some time off after that, didn't you? Because the pressure was quite great on you.
Well, I just found that I'd been living on adrenaline for some months. And when the summer recess came, it was as if the floor was taken away from under me. And I fell into a depressive state. Mm. A couple of anxiety, which I felt it was better to be open and honest about so that people, well, first of all, people would know the reason. And that was something that actually came as a great relief to me in being able to be open and honest about it. And I found it quite striking last week. I was at a primary school in my constituency on a visit, and there was a pupil in year six, and they said to me how pleased they were that I'd said something about living with anxiety because they were living with it as well. And I thought that was a deeply touching thing for a school child to say that to me. But yeah, it, you know, politics is cut and thrust, rough and tumble. It's not really set up and designed for shrinking violets, of which I wouldn't describe myself
you are not one,
as
you?
One of those.
But you're human.
Oh, very human. And certainly far from perfect. You know, but you find me a perfect person involved in politics. I don't think there are any.
No. Do you regret entering Parliament in 2015?
No. I joke about, you know, sort of being presumably on work experience and then they never let me leave. I was 27 when I became an MP. Oddly enough, I wasn't the youngest in that intake. I was only the fourth youngest, so yes. I didn't even get that accolade. I think Parliament needs a mix of ages and experience and backgrounds and everything else. Clearly, it might sometimes be better to, you know, make your way in the world first and then come to it in later life. But I think it is healthy for our democracy to have
all generations.
And is better for our policy making.
What advice would you give to that 10-year-old William Ragg now, who wanted to be an MP decades ago?
Well, what a therapy session this is, if I was to look at my inner child at 10 years old and say to him, I'd probably say to him, you know, stick at it, keep going. There will be times that you wonder what on earth you're doing.
There's no real training for it, is there?
There's no training whatsoever. There's no training, there's no job descriptions, no contract. But you tell me, you know, it's a way of life. Yes. It's a way of life. You're simply signing up to become something, and that's very important. Those two letters after your name, they sort of make you into something else. And the trick is being able to separate yourself from that, which arguably, although I may be completely wrong, but arguably, in deciding I'm not going to seek re-election, I am very, very gently putting that to one side.
Yes.
In an extremely healthy way.
Yes. Will others follow you? I mean, I think a dozen or so Conservative MPs have said they're standing down. Now, 40 or 50 quit in 1992. What people point out to me is the age, is there are younger people leaving politics now, which is surprising. But do you forecast more?
Well, I think actually, I don't know about what's the average length of tenure for a Member of Parliament? I think it's about 7 years. And, you know, at the next election, I would have done 9 years or so. Yes. I think what the remarkable, and I mean that in the old sense of the word, that people can remark upon, is that, you know, some of us started so young.
Yes.
And it leaves us in a very advantageous position to pursue other things, you know, but you know, yes. I don't want to, you know, whet people's appetite, but you never know what's going to happen in 10, 15 years' time, do you?
You could be back.
Who knows?
But you think there might be dozens more could go? I mean, is there a number you think? Have others said to you, thank goodness you've said?
A couple have done, and a number of have announced their intentions. I think some more will. But it has to be a personal decision as a personal choice for that yep. member of parliament. And they'll make the choice for all kinds of different reasons. The thing that I would hope is that they can do it from a positive perspective for themselves and not have any regrets of giving the public service that they will have all done
yes.
In however short or long their tenure as a member of parliament.
And what's next for you? I mean, you were a teacher before mm-hmm. you entered Parliament at 27.
You may have think this is completely reckless, but I do not know what is next. You know, I would be a concert pianist, but I don't play the piano. So beyond that, I don't rule too many things out. But as I say, you know, we wait to see who might look favourably upon a institutionalised and de-skilled former member of
de-skilled
Parliament.
De-skilled is a harsh term. I think you're terribly skilled at what you do. I think you've been a terrific backbench MP, an independently minded parliamentarian, and for that you deserve immense credit. William Ragg, thank you for joining us, and we'll keep watching what you're doing. But Matt's come back on this podcast when I've gone even greyer in 10 years' time, and we'll find out what you got up to.
Well, there's plenty of time left, yes. 18 months to 2 years, so you never
that's
know. There might be something interested in the meantime, but thank you again for the opportunity.
Great to have you on, thank you. William Ragg there. Coming up after the break, Tim Farron, the former leader of the Liberal Democrats, on why it's right to be proud of being a Christian in modern-day politics. Right after this.
Nigel Farage.
This is the most commonest thing done by any government in my lifetime in this country.
Lionel Shriver.
Which is worse, Biden's not being in control and Biden being in control?
Charles Moore.
I think if people in general feel that their traditions, culture, history, values, etc. are under assault, they are basically right.
My name is Stephen Edgington, and if you're enjoying this podcast, you might like Off Script, a new series from The Telegraph. Provocative conversations with provocative individuals. Each episode, I sit down with a world-leading commentator to unpick the ongoing culture wars. Unfiltered, unscripted, and full of free speech. Be sure to listen to Off Script in the same place you're listening to this, and make sure to follow so you don't miss an episode.
Now, Tim Farron was the leader of the Liberal Democrats until 2017. He led the party through that election and then quit, saying that he found that his personal faith didn't mix with being a leader of a major political party. This week, he's got a book out saying that politics and being a Christian can mix. He joins me now on Chopper's Politics, down the line from his office in Parliament. Tim Farron, welcome to Chopper's Politics. Great to have you on.
Chris, I'm honoured to be here. Thank you for having me.
You've got a book out this week called A Mucky Business, Why Christians Should Get Involved in Politics.
Mm.
Should get involved in politics. Now, let's take you back to 2017 when you resigned as Lib Dem leader. And you said then that you felt remaining faithful to Christ was incompatible with leading a party. Why the U-turn?
Not really a U-turn. More, I had come to the conclusion that for me, that was the case. And the case is basically because towards the end of my time as leader, particularly during that snap general election, a side story was me being asked lots of questions, difficult stuff about the Bible and what it taught about personal morality, because I guess people thought it was interesting that a person who's a liberal believes in the Bible is as an Orthodox Christian. And so I think I got myself into a situation, probably through my own lack of wisdom, I'm honest with you, where, and I concluded this during the campaign but kept it to myself, that I was either going to have to be a terrible leader and have to bat away this stuff constantly, or a terrible Christian by pretending that I didn't care about it.
Well, the issue was sex between two men. That was the issue. And you felt the Bible says you can't do it, but as leader of the Liberal Democrats, you have to be favourable.
I mean, the answer is if you're a Christian and if you're a liberal, you fundamentally believe in equality, that all people are made in the image of God. As a Christian, I believe that. And so we don't just believe in equality accidentally, biologically. We believe it at an enormously lofty level. You know, if you think about it, the most awesome thing we've seen through this James Webb telescope in the last few weeks, the most amazing cosmic structure you have seen, isn't as significant or as important as you are, Chris, or any one of us, because we're made in the image of God and we have ultimate dignity. So we believe in complete and utter equality, but also the Bible does say really difficult things about every bit of our life, not just sex, money, time, everything. But the tricky thing is you can't have those conversations when you've got 30 seconds of airtime, you're doing a general election. So the conclusion I reached anyway was that I would have to step, or I felt I was going to step off the podium as leader at some point after that general election, because I just thought being a terrible Christian or being a terrible leader, if they're the only choices I've got, that's a rubbish choice. I'll choose the third one, i.e., you know, stepping back, which I don't regret in any way, shape or form. But I also really have written this book, to be honest with you, not for people who are already involved in politics who are Christians, but for the 90%+ of people who are Christians and churchgoers in our country and beyond, who I think my experiences are often disconnected from politics because they either think, you know, against the backdrop of eternity, it's all very trivial, or they think that it is, as the book is called, a mucky business, and therefore they don't want to soil themselves for being involved with it, that we're at the compromises that are involved with it. And then potentially we also have the problem, and I do find it anecdotally, that some Christians, because of a suspicion of the culture that we're in, will therefore be suspicious of the mediators of that culture, people like you, Chris, and therefore end up being susceptible to fake news. And so I want Christians to care about politics, not to panic about it, and to value truth, not just the truth, but truth in general, and make sure that when they form opinions, they form those opinions based on evidence.
Does faith matter in politics? David Cameron used to liken his faith to Magic FM's reception in the Chilterns, i.e. patchy. Alistair Campbell said that Tony Blair, who did go to church, was Catholic, was not meant to do God when in office. Why is there this kind of crouch amongst people who are Christians in leadership roles in this country?
Everybody has faith, and it affects their worldview, whether they think it or not. If you are an absolute, I don't think most people are atheists. I think the single big, despite what the census says this week, the single biggest chunk of people in the country will define themselves as Christians, followed by various other religions, atheists, agnostics, lots of people with no religion. But if you're an atheist, that will affect your worldview. Because the fact that you don't believe in God, you don't believe there's an afterlife, you don't believe that you will be held to account for anything, and they're all legitimate beliefs, by the way, but you are having faith in there not being a God. You are trusting that there isn't a God, and that will absolutely have an impact, you might say positively, but that will have an impact on your worldview. So I guess the challenge I would make on the conversation about whether faith is relevant or acceptable in the public square, if everybody has faith, and I argue that they do, because everybody's trusting in something, then that's the third reading just gone, Chris.
Really sorry, but I should only give one vote.
I'll leave the line open. Okay.
I'll leave the line open. Thank you.
Cheers, Tim. Tim, you're back. How did you vote? The right way, I hope.
Yeah, but always the right way.
We were just discussing there, weren't we, about why previous leaders haven't gone there on their faith. But do you think that is the wrong approach? Do you think people want to hear that someone has a faith and is doing what they're doing for the right reasons?
Well, if you've been sort of simplistic about it, you could say, look over the other side of the pond and see. I'll have to check because of the recent elections. But before the elections in America, just the other week, only one member of Congress was publicly known as an atheist. Only the one. And so in the States, there's this sense that you have to kind of concoct a faith, even if you haven't got one, to be taken seriously. And maybe the thinking is in the UK, it's the other way around. You've got to kind of keep it hidden and all the rest of it. I'm not sure I actually think that so much now. I think what we need to do is have a bit of a conversation, a grown-up one, about what is faith and what is its place. And I'd simply say, I said earlier on that atheism is a faith. You are trusting in there not being a God, trusting in something, or the absence of something that affects your worldview. And so if you're a Marxist, or you buy everything that Milton Friedman wrote about monetarism in the free market, or Adam Smith, or anybody for that matter, we all, 100% of us, have a worldview. And so the notion that people with an established religious faith, let's say that, have to leave their worldview at the door and everybody else is allowed in, that's ridiculous, isn't it? It doesn't make any intellectual sense at all.
Well, why do MPs have prayers each day? And when they have those prayers, that they face the wall, don't they, in the chamber?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, so you, I know you know this works, but just so you, for listeners, the day does start with prayers, And they're good prayers. They're good, solid Church of England prayers. I'm happy to pray them out loud myself. And most of it, you chant. I don't know whether it's so we're not looking at each other whilst we're praying. I don't know what the reason is. But of course, the reality is that if, particularly on a busy day like Prime Minister's Questions Day on a Wednesday, if you turn up on time, put your prayer card in the back of your seat, and then turn up to prayers itself a couple of hours later, that seat is then yours for the rest of the day. So the reality is that prayers in Parliament are the Westminster equivalent to the Germans putting the beach towels on the sun lounges. And so why do we do it? I mean, this is all part of the fact that we have an established Church of England, and Christianity is sort of the official religion of the country still, even though I think in practice it has been for decades.
Is there a kind of cringe amongst our institutions about the church that you worry about, that you have Winterval this time of year rather than Christmas and this kind of thing? Does it bother you or not?
I mean, in one sense, it doesn't. I mean, first of all, I wasn't brought up as a Christian particularly. I made a choice at 18 on the basis of what I thought was the evidence that I would become a Christian and put my trust in Jesus. I also don't think that the job of Christians is to kind of, you know, colonise the country. And so the fact that, you know, you lose some of these symbols and traditions, it might be a little bit sad, but I don't think it's all that important. Certainly for me, it's Christmas. I will never spell Christmas with an X, no matter how much of a rush I'm in. And you know, it's silly to call it Winterval. I think people who are not Christians mostly respect the traditions, and I think that's a good thing.
And just coming on to that finally, on the census this week, Tim Farron, it showed that for the first time, less than half the population, 46.2%, although 27.5 million people describe themselves as Christian in 2021. That's a big fall compared to 59% or 33.3 million in 2011. Do you find that depressing?
Well, not culturally, because in one sense that's not a particular problem for me, and not in the sense that I think Christianity is dying out, because it obviously isn't. The explosion of the church in China, in Africa, South America, the rest of East Asia and so on tells you that Christianity is growing hugely, and it is the faith of the poor and the oppressed. The median Christian on planet Earth is black, female and under 20. So the thought that Christianity is dying out, it certainly isn't. Having said that, if I believe that people are only going to find eternal life, eternal meaning through a relationship with Jesus Christ, and there's fewer of them, that is tragic for each of those people. But I'm not convinced that the numbers that were reported in previous censuses actually reflected the number of people who were actively really Christian. They were, you know, if you'd asked me at 16, Tim, are you a Christian? And I'd probably say yes, just because it was the 80s and, well, I'm British, yes, I suppose I am. I think that mine was a generation that didn't go to church mostly. Mostly my parents' generation too, but my grandparents' generation did. And so people of my age, and maybe people from over 40, shall we say, and I'm over 50 now, will at least have sung hymns at school, will be familiar with some Bible stories. And people who are under 40, there's a total disconnect from all that kind of thing. So there's no knee-jerk reason for them to describe themselves as Christians. So I don't actually think, all we're really seeing is people offering a cultural description, not a faith one.
Do you think the response from the church should be do more politics?
Well, I certainly think...
When you see the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, speaking out on the small boats crisis, is that kind of thing?
Well, I think I certainly think that that Christians of all kinds should speak truth to power. I think it's interesting that when Justin Welby, of course, gave his Easter address, his Good Friday address last year, all the coverage was on the 30 seconds he'd spoken about Rwanda. And I kind of thought, well, you know, I agree with you, but maybe you shouldn't have said something so political. And then I actually looked at his sermon because I, you know, like everybody else, I just looked at the coverage of it. And he mentioned the resurrection more than 10 times. That's what his focus was. But he made a comment on the application of faith about how we love our neighbour and who our neighbour is, and used Rwanda as an example.
That's, of course, the policy to fly migrants to Rwanda to try and break the business model of the...
But my view is it is exactly the opposite.
But because that's a central point, though.
Mostly they meddle in politics.
Well, your word meddle.
So we have an established Church of England. I don't think we should, is my personal view. You know, I think disestablishment of the Church of England is not something I call for because I want Christianity tip-exed out. I just think that it's not right to have a state religion. It's not the job of the state. I also think it kind of pollutes the church. It stops them being as forceful as they might be.
Well, this conversation will be relevant going to the coronation, won't it, in May? And we saw, and that's why we had this coming together around the Queen's funeral, didn't we, in September?
We did, yeah. And I will see. And, so part of me thinks I like the fact that the Church of England's presence in every community is really important. But I do think they are compromised by the fact that they're part of the furniture of the state.
Well, Tim Farron, former leader of the Liberal Democrats, your new book, A Mucky Business, Why Christians Should Get Involved in Politics, is out now. And we'll put a link to how to buy that in the show notes to this episode. Tim, thanks for joining us in between votes in the House of Commons.
Yeah, thank you for being very, very tolerant and patient with me. It's lovely to see you again.
Great to have you on. All the best to you. Thank you.
Yes, Chris, God bless. Bye-bye.
Well, that's all for this week, listeners, from a rather noisy Red Lion pub getting ready for Christmas. And why not? Thank you to my guests this week, Simon Clark, MP, William Bragg, MP, and of course, Tim Farron, MP. Thank you to my producers, Louisa Wells and Giles Gear, and to my colleague, Meg Nananu. And a special shout out to Olive's mum. But most importantly of all, thank you to you all for listening. I really appreciate it. For more Westminster insights, do check out my daily Chopper's Politics newsletter. The link for that will be in the show notes to this episode. I want to have a peep at my Peterborough Diary column out on Friday evenings at 7 p.m. online and in Saturday's edition of the Daily Telegraph. But more important than my musings are yours. Dear listeners, please do share your thoughts on what our guests have had to say. Please email me, shopperspolitics@telegraph.co.uk, or tweet me. We're at Choppers Podcast. And remember, if you can, please do buy a copy of the Daily Telegraph. It's a great read and you won't regret it. Until next time though, from the Red Lion Pub, cheerio!
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.